ambition, rigor, and academic excellence. Those are just some of the promises of the best public high schools here in New York City. And this week, some students got big news about whether they would become part of the next group of elite graduates of the class of 2023. There are 8 specialized high schools in New York City that focus on the arts, math, and science. These elite public schools offer students a spot based on how well they do on a single standardized test. It's incredibly competitive, and historically, admission has been skewed when it comes to race. The same is true this year. Even though 70% of students in New York City are Black and Latino, only about 10% of students admitted to elite specialized high schools are Black and Latino. Stuyvesant High School, the most coveted, admitted 7 Black students out of 895 offers for incoming freshmen. And that's less than 1%. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. In just a minute, we'll look at the inequities in elite public schools across the country. But first, let's take a look at what's happening here in New York. Binash Ahmed is a producer here at The Takeaway, and she's been covering this for WNYC. Welcome to the show, Binash.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me about the test itself. I'm a student. I'm in junior high school in New York City. At what point do I know that I have to take this test or that I should take this test?
So that's a big question. A lot of students find out about this test years prior. Maybe they have siblings. Maybe it's a popular thing in their community where they've seen people go through these specialized high schools and really come home with a lot of success, go on to Ivy League schools. And then some students, largely the Black and Latino community, who make up a majority of students in this city, about 70%, don't hear about it as frequently. And for those students, it can be a challenge to really catch up, because what it takes to ace this test is focused study, right? There are test prep programs. They take it in eighth grade, and it doesn't necessarily cover items that they would see just sitting in the classroom normally.
So last year, you interviewed a bunch of students who were getting ready to take the test. One of the students you interviewed is Derek Zhang. Let's take a listen to what Derek had to say.
You see, like, everybody else, how, like, they're spending their time. They're, like, all having fun right now. But I know that in a few months, some of them aren't going to be as happy as they are now. So that's, like, kind of a motivation.
What's Derek telling us there?
So in that cut, you really hear what it takes to take this test. Derek is one of many students I spoke to who essentially cleared their lives to prepare for this test. They dropped extracurriculars. They dropped theater and band. And when I met him, it was in the fall of last year, right before he took the test. He was in his living room, just surrounded by workbooks. So he is one of those students who has done all of the work to get in.
Did he get in?
Well, he got into a specialized high school, but he didn't get into the one he wanted to go to. He was dreaming of a spot at the top specialized high school, Stuyvesant, but he didn't do as well as he liked on the test. And that's made him kind of question this test a little bit.
Now, you mentioned a statistic earlier, 70% of students in New York City are Black and Latino. Only 10% of students admitted to these elite specialized high schools are Black and Latino. I was one of those kids many, many years ago. The top school, Stuyvesant, is the one that's been getting the headlines, has admitted 7 Black students out of 895 offers. What can you tell us, Binash, that helps us explain this massive racial disparity?
Yeah, so part of it comes from looking at students like Derek and what they did to prepare and how much their parents and the institutions around them, their communities, have really made sure that they have what it takes to take this test. Now, the other side of the equation is the Black and Latino community, who may not even hear about this test. I was surprised by how little information trickles through to those communities. Last summer, I went to a high school admissions fair in the Bronx, which, of course, is majority Black and Latino, and I found that I talked to several parents, and no one of them had even heard of the test before. All of them were excited of having their kids take the test, but they would be competing at that point with students who had spent years preparing when they would have only months. That's something I talked to former New York City Deputy Mayor Richard Bury about. So he's a Stuyvesant alum. He was one of a few Black students who were admitted there. He's now the Chief of Policy and Public Affairs at KIPP, which is a charter school network. When I spoke to Richard Bury, he told me that it is absurd to call the system a meritocracy when it only admits so few Black students, that there is something fundamentally wrong with the system, in his view, if that is the outcome. Because he said there's no way that he can believe that there are so few Black and Latino students who are capable of doing well at the school. And so it's the system that's at fault, not these students.
There's also something for the Black and brown students who do get into these schools, the feeling of something known as imposter syndrome. What did he tell you about that?
So one thing I want to say up top is that Richard Beery went to Stuyvesant High School when there were about 200 Black students there. There's about 1/4 as many who will be in that school starting next year. So what he felt in terms of imposter syndrome, you can say, is, you know, going to only be magnified when there are even fewer students.
There's a constant sense of questioning of one's belonging. Why am I the only Black person here, and am I good enough to be there? You spend so much time second-guessing yourself of, do I belong here? It makes it all the harder to sort of sit and focus and to persist in school.
And I think that is that's something that I've heard not only from Richard Beery, but I spoke to alumni from Stuyvesant through the ages, so from the 70s, the 80s, 90s, and onward. And I found that for Black students at this school, the fewer other Black students there were, the harder a time they had, because a lot of them are coming from majority Black middle schools, from majority Black communities. And then to be one of only a few, they felt like they were a fish out of water and felt that their academics suffered because of that, because they weren't supported and they didn't have, you know, the community that they needed. There's also been documented incidents of racism at some of these schools. And, you know, it's a double-edged sword, because someone like Richard Beery will say that school opened doors for him. He went from there to Harvard, on to Yale. He has had a successful career, was former deputy mayor of the city. And yet he says he carried that imposter syndrome that was sort of planted in him as a high school student onward with him throughout his, you know, laudable career.
Binash Ahmed is a Takeaway producer and former WNYC education reporter. Binash, thanks so much for your reporting.
Thank you.
New York isn't the only city trying to figure out the right approach to prioritizing academic achievement and equity. There are approximately 165 so-called exam schools across the country that are dealing with these same issues. Aaliyah Wong is a staff writer at The Atlantic covering education and families. Thanks for joining us, Aaliyah.
Thank you.
So let's start with, where did this idea, because remember, we're talking about public schools here. So where did the idea of this selective admissions public schools come from?
Right. So it's kind of hard to suss out exactly what the origin story is. A lot of the schools that currently are selective have existed for centuries. But the model that we're talking about with places like Stuyvesant largely traces back to the Brown v. Board era, a time when we were seeing a lot of white flight, a lot of affluent families moving out of the public school system into private schools. And these institutions were in part a way to kind of attract them back into the public school system, to kind of introduce balance back into classrooms. Obviously, that's not necessarily the reality today, but I think they were well-intended and at least for a time may have served that purpose.
We talked just earlier about the racial disparities in these schools here in New York. I am a graduate of one of these schools, but I can tell you that, you know, with the Stuyvesant numbers today specifically, you know, less than 1% of those admitted are Black. And so is the data on demographics across the country similar?
I don't think they're nearly as egregious as in New York City. I think these schools, by virtue of the fact that they're academically selective, do tend to disproportionately enroll white students, Asian students, higher income students. Chicago's an interesting example. It's another city that has a pretty robust network of these schools. And a little under a decade ago, they created this algorithm to sort of at least ameliorate some of the discrepancies in socioeconomic status that we were seeing in the schools. So it basically called students from various socioeconomic tiers and guaranteed at least a few spots for students who might not otherwise even have a chance at these schools. But even in Chicago, while we did see improved socioeconomic diversity, they do still have higher numbers of white students than their regular counterparts. They do tend to enroll more wealthy students. So it's kind of hard to create a perfect system with this model.
What strikes me about this, Aaliyah, is also that these are, again, just reiterating, these are public schools. Why are all of our public schools not offering this quality of education?
I wish I knew the answer. I wonder that myself. When I first started reporting on these schools, it was out of just incredulity. I couldn't really figure out why there was a justification for them. I think, you know, that's really the irony of these schools because of the really founding mission of public education in this country, of public schools, is that they're meant to negate different destinies, that they're meant to kind of be engines of mobility, of really embodying the country's identity as a meritocracy. And it seems in a way that these schools are doing the exact opposite.
And what about the admissions and funding for a lot of these schools, Aaliyah? Like here in New York, we've got one test or one audition, you ace it or you don't. Does the same hold true for other states around the country?
As far as I know, and researchers seem to agree, that there isn't another city where this kind of exclusive focus on a very high-stakes exam is the only admissions criterion. There are usually array of factors that determine a student's admission. It looks a lot more like college admissions, at least at more selective schools, where you look at a variety of factors, arguably more subjective factors like their context and their personality, but it's quite an anomaly to just look at the test score, not even grades.
I want to ask you, here in New York City, there was a lot of political pushback to any changes to the test. Are you seeing that across the country? Are there folks who are wanting to really reinvigorate or change the system to make it more equitable?
I think there's generally a recognition that these systems aren't fair, but I don't think anywhere is as egregious as New York City that there is this real drive to overhaul the system.
Aaliyah Wong is a staff writer at The Atlantic covering education and families. Aaliyah, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
This is August in Portland, Oregon. When I was young, my mother worked to get me points for magnet programs in the LAUSD system. It's how I got into a gifted magnet in middle school and a humanities magnet in high school. The whole thing is still a mystery to me. It seems arbitrary and unfair. I am incredibly privileged to have a mother who could spend time and energy playing the system.
My name is Leanne. I'm calling from Olympia, Washington. My daughter attended an alternative public high school here in this area. It offered students a lot of independence. They required an application in order to get into the program that included an essay and an interview. To my knowledge, all applicants who have completed all those steps are admitted. I'm not sure how well that works for kids that have no help to apply or to get transportation. This school offers no transportation, so I had to figure out how to get my daughter there and back from our rural home 10 miles out.
Join the conversation on The Takeaway's Facebook page or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. When minors are caught trying to cross the border illegally, it's the responsibility of the federal government's Office of Refugee Resettlement to figure out where to house them. The government must document and disclose the existence and location of those facilities. But according to a new investigation by Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting, federal officials did not do that with the existence of at least five facilities that house unaccompanied minors. Aura Abogado helped break the story for Reveal, and she joins us now to talk about that investigation. Aura, welcome to the show.
Hi, Gonzina. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. So I want to just clarify. I mean, in your article, you call these facilities clandestine facilities. What does that mean? Were they just not reported? I mean, that seems to be at the issue here, right?
Right. We are saying that these are secret facilities, or were secret until we reported on this story a couple of days ago, because they were never disclosed to the attorneys for the class of unaccompanied minors that are in various facilities throughout the country. Those minors are represented by attorneys often referred to as the Flores Council. Flores was a huge federal settlement agreement, happened since 1997. And one of the main tenets of that agreement is that that council needs to know where their clients are, reasonably. How else are they going to know, you know, how to get to them, how to inspect the the sites, et cetera, and they've never been told about these five facilities.
Now, the federal government, you obviously talked to the or asked them why they had kept these facilities secret. Their response was?
Well, originally they weren't able to respond immediately. The government has since acknowledged that these facilities do exist. We had a lot of questions about how, about the exact mechanism. They still haven't told us. We don't know if these are letters of agreement, a subcontract. We don't think that it's a contract because we have, my reporting partner and I have vigorously looked at these federal contracts and haven't found any clue regarding any of these facilities. So we don't know the mechanism by which it happens. We also haven't been able to confirm from the government how many children are there. They acknowledge that it's approximately 15 to 20. That's, those are very different numbers. We have reason to believe that there may be more than five facilities. The government also isn't telling us how many facilities in total there are. And they're saying that this does abide by their guidelines, that the agency does keep guidelines that says that they do place children in out-of-network facilities. That is true. But again, according to the Flores Agreement, they should have told the attorneys for these children. And again, they failed to do that.
What can you tell us about the children who are inside these facilities?
We don't know too much. That's where I was really trying to focus in most of my reporting. When someone is affected, I like to, you know, not only talk about the policy and the advocates, but also the people who are most directly involved. And so I've only been able to speak to a couple of the sponsors for the children who are in there. But our understanding is that the children who are there do have mental health challenges and often behavioral challenges. Those are the reasons why they've been transferred sometimes multiple times from a traditional shelter into one of these places that we're broadly referring to as residential treatment centers that care for minors and sometimes adults with these kinds of challenges. One of the places we found is actually a hospital in Oklahoma, where, as far as we knew, and every other immigration reporter didn't think that there were any shelters for children, period. Now we find that at least one is being held in a hospital that also houses adults. A lot of those adults have made pretty serious allegations against that hospital. Inspection reports indicate that there are a lot of problems going on there.
One of the things I was thinking when you said these are out-of-network providers, could you be more specific there? Are these private companies and private organizations that are housing the children?
It's a combination. We've found that some of them are nonprofits, and we've also found that a couple of them, including that hospital in Oklahoma, as well as a residential treatment facility in Arkansas, are owned by a bigger company called Acadia Healthcare. It's a huge multinational healthcare provider. It not only is private, but it's also on the NASDAQ. And so, you know, part of the stock exchange now includes being able to buy and sell shares for a company that is dealing in the care of unaccompanied minors.
Let's talk a little bit about that care, because your reporting has also shown unaccompanied minors have been medicated against their will. We've heard reports of sexual abuse of children and even children who have gone missing after they've been separated from their parents. Are any of those concerns playing out now? What do we know so far?
We don't know, and the reason that we don't know is because we, as reporters, never knew about these places. That's part of the problem, right? Like, we're watchdogs. This is public money that's being used to fund this, and we didn't know that they existed. A lot of times, the attorneys for the children will they will go and visit the sites and make sure that everything looks good. They'll talk to the youth themselves and ask them what they're experiencing and what's happening there. There has been no opportunity to do this at these sites, so we don't know. It would make sense that perhaps children are being drugged at least some of these sites. Residential treatment facilities are known to do that, not necessarily in each and every single case, but that is often what does happen. We don't know if they are being forcibly medicated. We don't know if they're being medicated without their consent. At one of the shelters that had previously been known to us, that had been happening in Texas. So there's a lot more to report here.
Aura Abogado is an investigative immigration reporter for Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Aura, thanks again.
Thank you, Tanzina.
the wall. Good! Grand salami time for Mike Trout. We are tied at five.
Los Angeles star outfielder Mike Trout is set to become the highest paid athlete in the history of American sports. The 27-year-old will sign a deal worth $430 million over 12 years, which dwarfs the next richest professional sports contract by $100 million. News of the deal has had the sports world talking and left us here at The Takeaway wondering, what does that mean for the future of baseball and professional athletes in general? And so we decided we're going to reach out to Dave Zirin, the sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Dave, we're not making $430 million, but I'm happy to have you on the show anyway.
Well, happy to be here. Thank you so much. Let me tell you something. This is an eye-popping number. And yes, the whole sports world is agog with the ramifications of this contract.
I mean, let's talk about, first of all, baseball, 12 years feels like a really long time in any sport. But how does this 430 compare to other Major League Baseball contracts?
Well, as you said, it's the top contract by over $300 million, dwarfing the previous top deal that was just signed by Bryce Harper, which was over 13 years, $330 million. And let me tell you, by the economics of the game, we have to say Mike Trout deserves it. I mean, by age 26, he had the greatest statistics in the history of Major League Baseball, I mean, which is a stunning thing to say. I mean, at age 26, his wins over replacement, which is called WAR, wins against replacement, which is like how good you are relative to the next best player at your position, was the highest in Major League history. So if anybody was going to make this kind of money, it was going to be Mike Trout.
And yet, Dave, I had no idea who Mike Trout was. Yes. He's not a name that rolls off the tongue, and I like baseball. So what gives?
Well, first of all, you're right. If Mike Trout walked into this radio booth right now with a big sign around his neck that said, "Hi, my name is Mike Trout," it still might be tough to figure out that this is, in fact, Mike Trout. And that's one of the big criticisms of the deal, that unlike a player like Bryce Harper, who's such a well-known face and figure in the game, Mike Trout doesn't bring that oomph the way that other players in Major League Baseball or in American sports do. But at the same time, we have to realize that the California Angels, the team that signed him, or the Los Angeles Anaheim Angels, or whatever they're calling themselves these days, they have a $3 billion cable TV contract. They draw over 3 million fans a year. And so the idea that they would give him this kind of money, they're one of the few teams, frankly, that would have been able to do it and could have been able to afford it.
Dave, are mega deals like this what we're going to see going forward for elite baseball players in particular? What does this tell us about the future of these deals?
Well, it's interesting because Major League Baseball has a salary problem right now, and you're seeing class, if you will, develop on Major League teams in a pretty profound way. I mean, you might need Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or a Bernie Sanders to come step in and say something about Major League Baseball and how the rich and the poor are, you're seeing a big divide between the two. Currently, two-thirds of Major League teams have actually cut payroll while these mega deals are being handed out. And that gap is something that's making a lot of people very nervous about the future of the game. Two-thirds of teams cutting payroll. There are over 100, you could call them the middle class free agents, who are still out there waiting to be signed. And the union is requesting an audit to figure out why is it that all these major league teams are cutting payroll. They feel like they're in crisis mode because their union members aren't getting signed. Teams are slashing payroll, and yet this is happening side by side with players like Mike Trout getting these mega deals.
I think a lot of people think, okay, I make 400 kajillion million dollars a year or over 12 years. I'm a multimillionaire for life. Maybe that's the case for Mike Trout, but you just started pointing out the sort of class disparities that are really emerging here in Major League Baseball. What about other professional sports? Are there similar issues when it comes to the big money contracts and then the rest of the players, if you will?
There certainly is. I think in Major League Baseball right now, you're seeing a crisis in that class divide that dwarfs any other sport. But in every sport, we deal with these realities because the typical career in the National Football League is 3.5 years. I believe in Major League Baseball and the NBA, it's something like 5 or 6 years. So you're not dealing with much more time than that. So most people are really just hanging on to the edge of their jobs. I mean, we hear about the superstars, we hear about the big money deals, but the reality is that on these teams, you do have these huge gaps between the players who get the lion's share of what a team is going to pay and then the rest of the players. I mean, even on an NBA squad, you'll have three players making the majority of a team's salary cap of what they can spend. And if you think about that, that means 75% of the roster are really just fighting for what's left. And, you know, that can distort dynamics on different teams and create a situation where those players aren't really valued. You know, you're thinking that this is a superstar league or a players league, and if you have star players, then you're going to be fine. Well, look at the LA Lakers this year with LeBron James. Their record as we're doing this radio broadcast is 31-40. Their record last year without LeBron James after 71 games, 31-40. So it's a lot more than having a great superstar. You actually have to have players around that superstar who can create team culture, team vibe, and team continuity. And you're not having that valued in the same kind of way that you did in decades past. I'm sorry if that makes me sound very old, where if I say in my day teams were unified and they had players weren't making big disparities of money, but I will say it makes a very big difference in terms of the product on the floor.
Dave, it's okay. I mean, in my day, you know, I remember what you're talking about. But I do think, I mean, what does this tell us? You know, specifically going back to baseball, like minor league players are basically scratching, yeah, you know, the surface, just trying to get by. Could you unpack a little bit more about what happens, you know, when you have a LeBron James or when you have a Mike Trout or somebody like that on the team who's making that much money? I mean, isn't there a calculation that the team itself, the managers are factoring in here that goes beyond what, for example, what Mike Trout can do on the field? Aren't they banking on, you know, public relations? Are they banking on marketing?
Well, they certainly should be. And one of the things that the Angels like about Mike Trout a lot is that he's well known for reaching out to those minor league players. Like one of the downsides is that he's not this nationally known figure or even locally known figure in terms of his profile. One of the pluses is that it also means he doesn't have a big head. And he's always reaching out to the younger players, always reaching out to the minor league players and attempting to create that kind of team unity. And it'll be a real test, though, of his ability to play that kind of role now that he's going to be making a huge portion of what they're paying in salary. And this is an important thing to point out that I don't want to get lost in this discussion, is that one of the reasons why you're seeing so many teams cut payroll, 2/3 of teams cutting payroll, as I said earlier, is because teams are not dependent on winning for higher revenue. They're depending on cable deals, they're depending on public subsidies, and that creates, I think, also a very distorting environment where teams don't feel like they have to put the best possible product on the field. I mentioned earlier the Angels have a $3 billion local cable television contract. If that's the case, are you really worried about the fact that you're constantly finishing behind the Houston Astros in the standings? And that's an important thing for Mike Trout to think about as well, because now he's in a position where we can pressure management in the Angels to actually improve the team. Because if this goes 13 years and if Mike Trout continues his greatness and has a Hall of Fame career but doesn't have any bling on those fingers, no championship rings, then it won't be enough to say cash rules everything around me, because in sports, rings rule everything around you.
On that note, Dave Zirin is the sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Thank you again for joining us. We always appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
In 1997, a Mississippi man named Curtis Flowers was headed for death row.
Curtis Flowers was convicted of killing 4 people at a furniture store in this small town in Mississippi.
Samara Freemark is a senior producer for the podcast In the Dark from APM Reports, and her team has a new investigation about the Flowers case.
He was sent to death row, but that conviction was actually just the start of things for Curtis Flowers, because since 1997, Flowers has been tried a total of 6 times for those murders. He successfully appealed his conviction 3 of those times. 2 of the trials have ended in hung juries where the juries couldn't decide on a verdict. But the prosecutor in the case, who's been the same prosecutor the whole way through, he's a white man named Doug Evans. Evans just kept trying this case again.
And again, and again. And now Flowers' latest conviction from 2010 is on appeal at the U.S. Supreme Court. Oral arguments begin today. I sat down with Samara Freemark to talk about the investigation she and her team did into this case and what they found. But first, I had to ask the big question. How can someone be tried for the same crime six times?
So this is generally a question we get a lot when we tell people about this case. A lot of people hear that someone has been tried six times and they think, but wait a second, double jeopardy, that's not allowed. But the fact of the matter is that double jeopardy only applies if you've been acquitted of a crime. So if you're brought to trial and you're acquitted, the prosecutor can't charge you again. But Curtis Flowers has never been acquitted. He's only won his appeals or had juries hang. And so in that situation, the prosecutor constitutionally has every right in the world to just keep retrying him. And there's no limit, as far as we can tell, that says at a certain point you just have to stop. As far as what Doug Evans' motivations are, I think, from his perspective, he thinks Curtis Flowers is guilty and he thinks he has a strong case. And so I think he feels that it's his job as prosecutor to just keep trying this case until a conviction sticks.
So what is the Supreme Court set to decide here specifically?
So the question that the justices are going to be considering has to do specifically with what happened in jury selection in that sixth trial in 2010. So in jury selection, both sides, both the defense and the prosecution, get a certain number of what are called peremptory strikes. And they can use those strikes to remove prospective jurors from the jury for almost any reason. But one reason that you cannot use is race. So you cannot strike a black juror because they are black. That's unconstitutional. And Doug Evans, who is the prosecutor in this case, has actually been caught doing exactly that, removing a black juror because they were black, in two of Curtis Flowers' previous trials. And one of Curtis Flowers' convictions was actually overturned because of it. So in the latest trial, number six, Doug Evans used five of his six peremptory strikes against black prospective jurors. And the jury ended up being made up of 11 white people and one black person. Now, Evans and the state say that Doug Evans struck those people for constitutional reasons. You know, things like they worked with Curtis's relatives or they were late to court a couple of times. But Curtis's defense is saying, no, Doug Evans was doing the same thing in the sixth trial that he was caught for previously, that he was striking those black prospective jurors because they were black.
If Doug Evans had done this in the past and was caught doing it, why is he allowed to continue with this case?
Because there's no rule that prevents it. You know, this is the remedy here is in the courts. So Curtis Flowers can say something has gone wrong in my case. And his remedy is to appeal to a higher court, to a state Supreme Court, to the U.S. Supreme Court. And if they find he was right, that Doug Evans did make mistakes in the case, Curtis Flowers' remedy for that is he gets a new trial. And there's nothing in there that says there has to be a new prosecutor. So Doug Evans is the elected DA in that district, so he gets to keep trying it.
Okay, so you looked at the case and decided to investigate. Tell us what you and your team were trying to find.
So our involvement in this story started with a tip. We got a very short email from a woman who lived in Mississippi who said, you know, there's a man here who's been tried six times for the same crime, and the evidence against him seems iffy at best. And to us, the most interesting part of that tip was the six trials part, because we had that same reaction that you did, which was six trials. This doesn't seem right. This doesn't seem possible. And so we went into it with this question essentially of what is going on here. Like, how did this person, Curtis Flowers, come to be tried six times by the same prosecutor? And answering that question ended up entailing a huge amount of reporting into every aspect of the case. So we really looked at everything, every bit of evidence that the DA presented in those six trials to juries. Our team spent more than a year reporting on this case. And by the time we were done, we had really found that a lot of this evidence didn't hold up to scrutiny.
But then you found something else out about Evans in his office. Tell us about that.
So we knew that Doug Evans had this history in the Curtis Flowers trials of striking black jurors at higher rates than he struck white jurors. That's in the record. We were very familiar with that. But that led us to this larger question, which is, what is Doug Evans doing in all of the other cases that his office has tried? Because Doug Evans has been the prosecutor in this district since 1991. So he's tried hundreds of cases, or his office has tried hundreds of cases. So we had this very specific question, like, what is going on in jury selection in all of these other cases? It turned out that answering that question was a huge challenge. It took months and months of work. We had a reporter who had to go courthouse to courthouse in all of the 8 courthouses of Doug Evans' district and track down all of these paper transcripts of jury selection in all of these trials. And these things were stored in all kinds of weird places, like there was some in this old abandoned men's bathroom or in a former jail, a storage container. So she had to track down all these transcripts and scan them all. And at the end of it, I believe she scanned, 115,000 pages of documents. And so then we took all of this information, all of these scans, and we gave them to our data reporter. And our data reporter spent about 3 months coding all that data, entering it into a huge spreadsheet, developing a methodology with some statisticians, and running the numbers on this. And at the end of that, months and months later, we had an answer, which is that Doug Evans was striking Black potential jurors in his district at 4.5 times the rate that he struck white potential jurors.
What could Evans face? Could he pay for this in any way?
I mean, again, there's no penalty for the prosecutor in this. So even if the Supreme Court hears this case and decides that Doug Evans has struck Black jurors because they're Black in violation of the U.S. Constitution, if they rule in Curtis's favor and they say Evans is at fault here, what happens after that is that the case is back where it's been so many times before. It's back in the hands of the district attorney, Doug Evans, and he'll get to decide what to do with it. And he'll get to decide whether he wants to try it for a 7th time.
What do you want people to understand about this case specifically and about this reporting? Because this does seem like a pretty unique case for the Supreme Court to take up.
Yeah, it's not the kind of case that the Supreme Court usually looks at. We've talked to a lot of experts about it, and you know, this is not a Bush v. Gore. This is not a Roe v. Wade. This is not a case with huge national implications. It seems to be a pretty what they call a fact-bound case, a case that really is about what happened in this one particular courtroom, in this one particular trial, which again is not the kind of case the Supreme Court usually looks at. But I think that it gets to all of these larger issues in the criminal justice system. Like, we hope that our reporting and that the Supreme Court's taking of this case encourage people to take a look at what their prosecutors are doing in jury selection.
Samara Freemark is senior producer for the podcast In the Dark from APM Reports, and you can find her team's investigation into the Curtis Flowers case and DA Doug Evans at thetakeaway.org. That's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.